This is Scott Verguin of KSOWLP in Cottage Grove, Oregon. We have on the line Karen Button, an independent journalist out of Alaska, who is currently in the Middle East in Amman, Jordan, doing some important work there. Hello, Karen.
Hello, how are you doing, Scott?
I'm doing great. I must admit it's a bit of an odd experience to be sitting in Oregon talking to somebody in Jordan, but I suppose there's some people that are very used to that sort of thing. Can you begin, if you would, by telling us a little bit about your trip there and what you are focusing on? What took you to Jordan and the Middle East?
Well, I've come to Jordan twice this year now to interview Iraqis who have fled Iraq because of the current war and occupation.
And being in Jordan, there are, I believe there's refugee camps all along the border with Jordan and Iraq, is that correct?
There's actually just one refugee camp here, and it's called Ruwaishid. It is very close to the Iraqi border, that's correct. At the current time, I visited there in June, and there were about 700 families there, and at this point there's about 350.
Okay.
The thing that's important for people to know is that there are people that are stuck between borders, and that's a very concern.
They're stuck between borders, did you say?
Exactly.
Okay, so they can't go back into Iraq or don't want to and can't get into Jordan, is that what you mean?
Exactly. There's about 190 of them, and they have fled from Iraq, and the Jordanian government, although they agreed in the beginning to cooperate with the United Nations High Commission on Refugees and allow anybody that was fleeing Iraq to come into Jordan, what's currently happening is that they have closed their borders and they're not allowing anybody else in.
So what position does it put these people in? Are they able to get the aid that they need to survive in that sort of no man or no person's land it sounds like that they're in?
Well, the United Nations High Commission on Refugees has told me that they are doing their best to get supplies to them, and then the ICRC, the International Committee on the Red Cross, is also helping to get some supplies to them. So they do have tents, they do have food rations and this sort of thing. The medical care isn't the greatest. But I think people's biggest concern there, I just spoken with people on the phone, and the biggest concern that people have there, of course, is that they're going to just be stuck there. The Iraqi border has said that they will let them come back into Iraq, of course, and that's what the UNHCR is trying to do. But these people, for understandable reasons, really want to get back to Iraq.
Right. Can you help us a little bit with the geography for those of us who don't are having a hard time picturing the location of these things? Jordan is on the the southwest side of a corner of Iraq. Is that where the border is?
Right.
Okay.
Yeah. Exactly.
And can you locate that, for example, in relation to places like I think it's Anbar province. Is that the one that's close to Syria that there's been so much violence in?
Right. That's just north of the Jordanian border.
Okay. So I guess some of these people are refugees from that area.
Well, most of these people are actually Iranian Kurds who were living in Iraq in refugee camps there, having fled Khomeini's government in the late 70s and early 80s. And they are from an area close to Ramadi.
Okay.
So the people that are actually in a border of Syria, those are people who are Arab Iraqis, and they are the reason that there's been so much resistance or so much fighting in that area is because the resistance is actually quite strong to the occupation in that area.
Right. So these are.
Although I do want to mention that that one of the biggest problems in the West right now along that border with Syria is that thousands of families have been made homeless by the siege that the U.S. has laid upon these communities. Mm-hmm. They've been doing operations there since early May of last year. So the Iraqi Red Crescent is quite concerned about these people, and the types of munitions that the U.S. is using on their villages include 2,000-ton bombs.
Wow.
And there's very little information that's coming out of the West, primarily because getting, it's very remote, and getting there, there's only access by a couple of roads, and I'm told that from some of the doctors that I've spoken to that have gone there, they said that those roads are very easily controllable by U.S. and U.S.-led Iraqi forces, so they're quite adept at being able to keep out the media that they don't want in.
Right. All eyes seem to be on Baghdad most of the time, as if it's the only trouble spot, so-called trouble spot, in Iraq. So these sounds like very long-term refugees. I mean, that surprises me. And it seems to be I'm sure it's not totally unique to the Middle East, but it makes me think of the Palestinians and how long some of them have lived in refugee camps. And the issues are not totally unrelated, are they?
Well, no, of course they're not unrelated. I mean, you could look at, as most people here in the Middle East do, they look at most issues here as related to the problems in Israel and the fact that the U.S. has been so supportive of that government and its tactics against the Palestinians.
Right. You'd mentioned doctors before, and I know that you've been real supportive of an organization, if I have the name right, Doctors for Iraq. Is that correct?
Right.
And could you tell us some about that organization, who they are and what they do?
Yeah, Doctors for Iraq is an organization of about 200 medical workers and doctors.
Mm-hmm.
And what they've decided to do is they go to areas that are under siege, and they help to provide medical care to those areas, knowing that that the doctors there are going to be really struggling with the amount of people that have been injured, but also because what unfortunately has been a common occurrence is that U.S. forces and U.S.-led Iraqi forces have routinely been surrounding hospitals, not allowing people to come into the hospitals, shooting ambulances, and sometimes, as was the case in Haditha, which is also in the West, they actually occupied the hospital for 5 days.
Right.
So Doctors for Iraq goes into these areas. The U.S. force have told the doctors in these areas, the areas that are under siege, that they are not allowed to provide any medical assistance for so-called insurgents. The problem, of course, being that it's impossible to tell who's an insurgent and who's not unless somebody's actually wearing a uniform.
Mm-hmm.
But beyond that, these doctors tell me that it's really not their job to determine who's in the insurgency and who's not. Their job is to treat people, and their job is actually protected under the Geneva Conventions. They are allowed under the Geneva Conventions to treat anybody who needs medical care.
Yes, well, excuse me, I know there's been lots of testimony on this, what you referred to as like the occupation of a hospital and hospitals and those sorts of things by the U.S. and U.S.-led forces. Testimony in, what would you call them, citizens' tribunals that have happened quite regularly, and I know that you attended one, I believe in Egypt, is that correct, as part of this trip?
Right, right. I attended one at the end of June that was in Istanbul.
Istanbul.
And that one was organized primarily through the other tribunals. There have been 20 tribunals throughout the world, but not in the Arab world.
Mm-hmm.
And so what the importance of this one in Cairo was at the beginning of this month was that it was actually organized by Arabs. It was organized by the Arabs Lawyers Union, and it was held in an Arab country.
Mm-hmm.
And what these folks are trying to do is to link up the movement, the tribunal movement, if you will, between the Arab world and the European, Asian, and American world.
I know it's an important thing, and I assume there'll be more tribunals. And I was reading your interview with George Galloway, the Member of Parliament of Britain, who's been very outspoken against the war. And he testified there, of course. And I'm wondering if this is something that is going to continue, if there's more of these planned.
Right. Well, a couple of things that I want to respond to that is, one is that George Galloway actually didn't testify at the tribunal, and the reason was because he was detained by the Egyptian authorities.
Uh-huh.
The other groups that were supposed to be witnesses, who were Palestinians and also Iraqis, were all denied visas to come into Egypt. So I think that's a really important piece
right.
that we have to acknowledge, because One of the problems in this region, of course, is that there are governments who are very friendly with the U.S. and the U.S. policies, one of which is Egypt, mm-hmm. another of which I might add is Jordan, which is sometimes called the 51st state. So this is something that's really, people in Egypt were very happy that the Egyptian government actually even allowed the tribunal to take place there. Yeah. And that's one of the things that I think is a very important part of the whole discussion, because we're looking at a region that has some very harsh regimes, and people here are really trying to move forward in a way that that they can join their counterparts in other parts of the world. And the Arab Lawyers Union is actually a union of the bar associations of all of the different Arab countries. Hmm. So it was a pretty powerful group that was behind this. At this point, I know that there's been some talk about having another tribunal on the West Coast in the United States, mm-hmm. but as far as I know, there hasn't been any reorganizing. There's no dates that are set, and there hasn't been any real organizing efforts in order to make that happen. The way that it ends up working is that citizen groups in a particular community decide that they want to hold a tribunal. Mm-hmm. And then they start organizing it on their own. The tribunal, the World Tribunal on Iraq, as these other 20 were associated with, they actually don't organize the tribunals. It's something that's very grassroots. But then they have the expertise, of course, of all of the other tribunals to work with, and they have this vast network now around the world of people who are anti-war and who are really looking at the issues of American-led imperialism and what to do about it, because everybody, I think, is quite aware in this realm that the U.S. isn't going to stop with Iraq. Mm-hmm. If the U.S. government has its way, it's going to expand out further. And we're seeing some of this, of course, now in Iran.
Right.
And also the U.S. threats in Syria.
Mm-hmm. Well, that brings me back down to the ground, in a sense. I'm wondering, going back to thinking about these refugees, the people who have fled or trying to flee from Iraq, their situation, what kinds of, what are you hearing from these folks in terms of the situation, the conditions, their thoughts on where they're, the situation that their country is in and their hopes for the future? That's a big, long question, I know, very involved, but I guess what are you hearing from these people?
Well, that's a really good question. Most of the people who are at the refugee camp are, as I said, people, even those who are across the border and those who are actually in the refugee camp here in Jordan, are Iranian Kurds. Mm-hmm. There are some Palestinians, there are some Iraqis. But the majority of the Iraqis who are now in Amman are people who are either, they have fled and they're really living under their radar screen here. They're, mm-hmm. You see them, there's old women that are working on the streets selling cigarettes and gum and things like this, mm-hmm. and really just struggling to get by. There's one man that I know that has a little tea shop, and his is kind of a little local gathering place. And these people often are living without work permits here. So if they are caught, then they're often deported back to Iraq. And then there are the Iraqis who actually have the money to be able to leave Iraq, and many of them have either purchased apartments here or they come here regularly just to have a little bit of a break from the violence that's mm-hmm. in Iraq. It's hard to say exactly how many Iraqis are in Jordan right now. The official figures are about 300,000, although people on the street tell me it's more like 500,000 to 600,000. Mm. There's a larger community, of course, that's in Syria, because the Syrian government is much more friendly towards Iraqis. Right. Unfortunately, here in Jordan, it's what's become very hard for a lot of Iraqis, is that the Jordanian government has been in partnership, I'll say, with the United States since the beginning of the war. In fact, most of the ground troops that went into Iraq actually came through Jordan. I mean, this is where they were based out of, and Jordan was used as the launching point.
Well,
a lot of people will think that they came out of Saudi Arabia or Kuwait, but mm-hmm. the majority actually came through Jordan.
Yeah, I was going to say, I don't think that's a well-known fact. I mean, that's something that I didn't know, and I'm not to put myself out as knowing a lot about the war, but I've certainly spent a lot of time on it mm-hmm. working against the war. But I think most people would assume that you're right, that they you hear more about Kuwait, for example, People assume that, and of course, some troops did come out of Kuwait. But is that another one of those stories that the mainstream media, in cahoots with the government or something, has decided we're just not going to talk about this?
Well, it's hard to say, of course, why it isn't being reported on, but I think one of the reasons is because the U.S. doesn't really have any acknowledged military bases here. The bases that the U.S. does have, or the military facilities, I guess I'll call them, are actually, they're secret. I mean, people here tell me that they think that there's about 14 or 16, but nobody really knows for sure. There's also people acknowledge that there's secret U.S. prisons in Jordan as well, but nobody really knows exactly where they are. And it's, I think that the Jordanian government passed a law about a month ago, it's been, maybe 5 weeks, that I think really kind of sums it up, and that is that they decided that no U.S. soldier could be tried in Jordan.
We've heard of this before in other places. I think that's one of the things that the Bush administration was pushing for. That was one of the reasons why they don't haven't signed on to the International Criminal Court, of course.
Mm-hmm.
Well, what's the word that people use? Impunity. This going about the world and you know, with all the torture scandals and stuff that's going on that I'm sure we've just scratched the surface on. It's amazing. I mean, doesn't that kind of put Jordan's neck out there in terms of the their relations with the rest of the Arab world and so on? I mean, in their region?
Well, as I say, they're not alone. I mean, the Egyptian government is quite close with the United States, as is Kuwait, Saudi Arabia, the United Arab Emirates.
Mm-hmm.
They're not alone in that. And that's one of the problems in this part of the world, of course, is this disunity that's felt. And it's one of the things that people really were hopeful about in the Cairo trial.
Mm-hmm.
The trial there was, you know, all of these tribunals, of course, have been symbolic.
Right.
There is no, at this point, there's no legal teeth for which to try the United States in particular. As you mentioned, they're not part of the International Criminal Court. And the documentation, the preservation of the history of what's happening is really one of the important pieces. But and also then, of course, if there is an avenue in the future to take these governments to court, then all of the documentation already exists.
Mm-hmm.
So one of the very important pieces that came out of the Arab Tribunal was all of these countries working together. I mean, there were witnesses, for example, from Libya. The man from Libya, he's the head of the Arab Farmers Federation. And this is an organization that unites the farmers, the collective farm workers from throughout the Arab world. And there were people that were coming from a lot of the different Arab nations to this tribunal. And one of the things that was very interesting is in the middle of somebody's testimony, this man said, look, you know, it's really important that we're putting Bush and Blair and Sharon on trial here, but let's also hold a separate trial, and let's look at our Arab government. Which, of course, everybody was very, you know, they clapped for him and then said, well, of course, we know that can't happen because it would never be allowed. But at least there was this acknowledgement of that sentiment and that there needs to be much more Arab unity, at least on the street, if not between the governments.
Mm-hmm. Well, that seems to be very key. And there's a long, tumultuous road to go, apparently. And unfortunately, our government, the United States government, is not helping. Doesn't appear to be helping in any way. It's often you can try to look and find, you know, in any situation, you can look and say, well, there's something positive, but to tell you the truth, I can't find anything. Everything seems to be spun maybe to look positive to some people, but it's always, if you dig deep and talk to people like yourself and listen to other folks that have spent time and thought about the Middle East, there's always something negative under the surface. And it's great to see, to hear about these tribunals, and I hope they do continue. And I know, unfortunately, this is a thing, I may have missed it, but I don't know that this has been covered at all in the mainstream media in this country.
The Cairo Tribunal,
yes,
or any of them?
Well, yeah, good point. Good point. Any of them, definitely.
Exactly.
Unless you listen to Democracy Now.
Right.
Or, you know, get on the internet and pay attention to some of the better independent news sources. You wouldn't even know.
Well, what was interesting at the Cairo Tribunal is that I was the only Western journalist who was there.
The only one.
So, yeah, well, there was one journalist who showed up from The Independent.
Mm-hmm.
He's the stringer from Australia, and mm-hmm. he's based here in Cairo. And he came to the morning session of the first day, and that was it.
That was it.
Of course, to be fair to him, there was also a huge ferry accident that happened in Egypt. Maybe you heard about it in the
yes.
States, but many hundreds died, and that happened actually on the same day. The same day as the trial began.
Okay. Well, see, I do remember that one. That one was covered. That was certainly covered in the mainstream media.
Right. Yeah, and it was a very impressive panel of judges. The former Prime Minister of Malta was on the panel, the former Prime Minister of Malaysia,
mm-hmm.
A former judge from The Hague. These were all people that were part of the panel of judges.
Mm-hmm. Well, I guess we can only hope that the accumulation of these tribunals and other actions will finally, you know, we will be able to look back on it, as George Galloway said at some point, and say, well, that tribunal in Cairo was really seems to be the one that turned the tide or whatever. Anyway, so you're going to be in Amman in the Middle East for how much longer?
I actually will just be here for another week or so.
Mm-hmm.
I've been here since January, and my time is about to wrap up here.
Mm-hmm. And what are there other things that you're hoping to accomplish before you do leave?
Well, I've been interviewing as many Iraqis as I can, as I can while I'm here,
uh-huh.
and many of the Iraqis that I've met and interviewed here
mm-hmm.
Have been victims of torture, unfortunately,
mm-hmm.
at the hands of both the Americans and the Iraqi government.
Right.
And that's part of what I hope to continue doing while I'm here, is to just uncover that. We've seen a lot of it coming out recently, you know, new information coming out. The administration wants to discount it,
mm-hmm.
Of course, these new photographs from Abu Ghraib, and say, well, these people have already been punished. But we know that they haven't.
Mm-hmm.
Even if it's the same people in these new pictures, even if it's the same people who have already been convicted, what we know is that those orders came from somewhere else, and those people haven't been convicted.
Right.
So this is the thing that I think is really important, is to really talk to the people who have had these experiences and who have suffered from them,
mm-hmm.
and to really get across to the Americans, that the American public, that these are not isolated events.
Right.
It's a systematic way of treating detainees.
Right. And it's also, it seems very important that you're in the process of documenting these people's stories, because
right.
they may be, hopefully they'll become more valuable as time
right.
goes on. All right. Anything else you'd like to share with folks? A point that you didn't get a chance to make, or you want to reemphasize or anything before we close?
Well, I'll just close with something that I almost always ask Iraqis when I'm done interviewing them, and that is, if you had the chance to say something to George Bush or the American public, what would you say?
Okay.
And without doubt, the biggest thing that Iraqis really want to know is, why is it that the American public, why is it that the American people are allowing these atrocities to go on in our country? They say that they want to bring democracy, but this is not democracy. We had a better life under Saddam Hussein. And without exception, every Iraqi that I've spoken to will say to me, I hated Saddam Hussein, he was a brutal dictator, but... And I never thought that I would say this, but I even wish for his return, because we had security, we had food, we had electricity, we had jobs, and this is none of which we have now.
Well, well said. I think you're right. It's very important somehow to keep trying to find ways to get this through the apparently very thick heads of our U.S. Fellow citizens. Thank you for that, and I will look forward to reading more of your dispatches. At some of them are at www.insurgent49.com. That's
right.
Out of Alaska, right? And you were going to share another website that you think is a good one to keep up with information.
Right. Another good website is uruknet.net, and that's spelled uruknet.net. And they're out of Italy, and they do a really good compilation
Okay. All right. Any other contact information you want to share with folks?
I think that's it. Thanks
okay.
very much for your time and
okay.
And for the interest of your listeners.
I was talking to Karen Button, independent journalist from Alaska and currently in the Middle East in Amman, Jordan. You can get in touch with Karen at karenbutton@blogspot.com. This is Scott Burguin of KSOW LP in Cottage Grove, Oregon.